This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Yeah, I'm going to start, and I'd make a bold prediction that we won't get too many people on Facebook or Twitter from this audience. But I mean, I might be completely wrong about that. This is our second appearance here. We came here to publicise Fantasy Island. I think it was 89 years ago. I'll just briefly tell you how we came to write this book. The book started really in the summer of 2015 when a publisher came to us and said, would you like to write a book about the euro from a left-wing perspective? This is before the date of the Britain's referendum had been announced. And it was the time of the sort of the Grexit was all the rage then, and there was sort of left wing in favour of exit from the EU as a result of what was going on in Greece, and essentially we are, despite what Damon says, we have actually been quite consistent about our views about the euro and the ERM, which came before it, and in a position really to say, we told you so. We're not Johnny Come Latelys here. We said from the outset that we thought these would be the euro would be an ill-begotten project, and essentially we came at it from a left of centre perspective, which I think was what the publishers wanted. I mean, really, from the sort of tradition in the Labour Party of Austin Mitchell or Brian Gore or even Tony Benn, which essentially would say that the attempt to put together a single currency for Europe was going to be deflationary, that it would be anti-democratic, and that in terms of any adjustment costs, they would fall upon ordinary people rather than on the owners of capital. And essentially, our view was and remains that there's nothing remotely left-wing about the single currency project, and that was really exemplified by what happened to Greece, which was when an IMF structural adjustment program came to Europe. I mean, it wasn't the only country, but essentially Greece, Portugal, Ireland, you know, even Ireland, sort of poster child of Europe, had an IMF-imposed structural adjustment program of the sort that was normally reserved for banana republics in sub-Saharan Africa. And, I mean, our view, expressed long before the euro was created, was that this would prove to be a burning building with no exits, because a country that gave up control of its exchange rate and its interest rates, and where there was no mechanism for large-scale fiscal transfers, would really have only two choices in the event of an asymmetric shock. Well, one would be to leave the single currency altogether, or secondly, to go through a process of a massive internal devaluation, which is effectively what's happened to countries like Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and to a lesser extent, Spain. So that was our starting point. There was a real obvious divergence between what the euro was supposed to do in theory and what we expected to happen in practice. And, you know, you run through four big objectives of the single currency and see how they turned out in practice. Well, object number one was to harmonise the economies of the member countries, you know, to bring them more into line with the lead country, Germany, in terms of their economic performance, their productivity, their competitiveness. And the opposite has proved to be the case. There's been divergence, not convergence. In fact, there's been an IMF study which shows that countries in Eastern Europe that didn't join the euro have actually converged more closely with Germany than countries like Greece and Portugal did inside the single currency. So there's been divergence rather than convergence. And clearly, the euro was supposed to lead to higher levels of economic growth and lower levels of unemployment. And, of course, we now know that, you know, there's 10% unemployment across the European Union. growth rates have plummeted. You know, it's an occasion for wild celebration when the European Union grows at 1.5% a year. You know, even in the first quarter after Britain left the European Union, Britain still managed to grow faster than the single currency zone did. So it's become a sort of byword for low growth. Thirdly, the euro was supposed to complete the job of closing the gap between Europe and the US. So, you know, there's been a gradual convergence in GDP per head between Europe and the US after the Second World War. That came to a shuddering halt in the late 1990s, just about the same time that countries were gearing up to join the single currency. No accident, in our view. And finally, the euro was supposed to be the way in which political union in Europe was hastened. It was supposed to be a stepping stone to close integration. Of course, as we can see now from events with the Five Star Movement in Italy, the Front National in France, Alliance for Deutschland in Germany, everywhere you look across Europe, not just in Britain, the euro has actually led to political discord and disintegration rather than integration. I mean, so let's just go back a bit and say, why did Britain join the European community in the first place? I think that it essentially was a transactional relationship. I mean, when Macmillan first applied to join back in the early 1960s, it wasn't for the same reasons that other countries did. It wasn't because Britain had been invaded or invaded somebody else, or it wasn't because Britain had a dictatorship. It was essentially because we looked across the channel and thought they were doing better than we were. So, you know, the Germans seemed to have sorted out their industrial relations in a better way than we had. The French had got indicative planning. They'd planned their economies and it seemed to be working for them. Italians had got, you know, reputation for great design. You know, she looked across the channel and saw, you know, whether it came to training, education, financing of business, the Europeans seemed to have got it sorted and we hadn't. And essentially that's the sort of British, I think, you know, goes to the heart of the British model of capitalism, which is really based around what works. You know, it was essentially an empirical model. We looked to them, they looked as though they were doing better than we were, not just in terms of their growth rates, which were higher, but just in the way they were managing their economies, and it looked like it worked for them. And so, you know, I see the attempt to join the common market in the 60s and early 1970s as really just an admission that they were doing rather better than we were. So it was a sort of gigantic inferiority complex in some ways that the Europeans were doing better than we were. And it was the latest in a whole range of ideas that were floated to sort out the problems of the UK economy after the Second World War. So we had nationalisation, we had Butskillism, we had indicative planning with the National Plan, we had George Brown and so on. We had, you know, attempts to improve our productivity. And Europe came as the latest one of these ideas that was going to turn the economy around. And it sort of really reached its apogee at the moment when Britain joined the ERM in 1990. That was when the cringe was at its greatest, really. It was at the moment where we'd had the second bout of high inflation within a decade. We tried all sorts of ways of getting inflation down from targeting the public sector borrowing, targeting the broad measure of the money supply, the narrow measure of the money supply. We tried pretty much everything. So eventually we decided that the only way to do it was to actually import some German discipline and join the ERM. Well, that proved to be the end of our inferiority complex. 2 years inside the ERM proved to be enough. To a bit of shock treatment was enough to sort out that problem. And I think that Dan will take up the story, but essentially that period did actually make Britain a lot more cautious when it came to the single currency debate at the end of the 90s and the start of the 2000s, because, as I say, Britain's version of capitalism is, I think, somewhat different from the way in which the Eurozone is organised. Ours is based around what works. If it doesn't work, try something else. Theirs is based around the idea that if it's not working, you just try a bit more of it until it does work. The European project does not work on the basis of, you know, if something's failing, try something else. It's based around what ought to happen according to the blueprint. And if the blueprint doesn't work, then you try a bit more of it. And that effectively was what happened during the 1990s and the 2000s, that as the European project ran into problems, the idea was not to take a step back and say, what are we doing? What were we doing right previously, and what are we doing wrong now? But just intensify the attempts to integrate more quickly. And so, what looked like a good idea back in the 50s and 60s, you know, during the biggest beautiful days of the 50s and 60s, started from this side of the channel to look like a less good idea in the 90s and 2000s. After all, quite a lot of those ideas that were seen to be great ideas in Britain in the 1950s, you know, high-rise flats, turning the whole of Birmingham city centre into a motorway. All those ideas looked a lot less good in the noughties and the 2000s. But the idea that a big is beautiful, more integrated Eurozone was a good idea, you know, never seemed to die. Before he became a celebrity, you know, before he became an expert on the Foxtrot and the Paso Doble, Ed Balls did say something quite interesting about the interface between economics and politics. His view was always that countries that made economic decisions for bad political reasons ended up with both bad economics and bad politics. And he pointed in one of his speeches to, you know, Britain's decision to go back on the gold standard in 1925 and the decision to join the ERM in 1990 as decisions that were taken for bad political reasons, which ended up with disastrous economic consequences. And another example of that, really, I think, was Germany's being bounced into setting up the single currency by the French at the Maastricht talks in 1991. I think the Germans, and particularly the German Bundesbank, thought that the single currency should come at the end of a process of political integration, be the crowning moment of the whole project. And the French said, no, don't worry about it. Actually, having the single currency will lead to this economic and political integration, and it will actually be the catalyst for it. And the Germans thought, I mean, one of the chapters of our book talks about how the Germans thought that what they were going to end up with was a sort of system based around the same model as Gordonstown School in the north of Scotland, where Prince Charles went to school, you know, where it was cross-country runs and cold showers in the morning, and everybody would be disciplined into the harsh realities of competitiveness. And it ended up more like Summerhill, the sort of alternative school in Suffolk that A.S. Neill set up, where everybody decided whether they wanted to turn up for lessons or not, that actually everybody went their own way, in fact, including the Germans. And instead of actually buckling down to their lessons, it was a case of countries like Greece and Portugal going for a quick fag behind the bike sheds. When the crunch came, the Germans decided that they would impose the discipline they'd wanted to have all along. But by then, the damage had been done, not just in the Eurozone, but in countries like Britain, which looked across the channel, saw that the Eurozone clearly wasn't working. And that, I think, has had a really profound impact on the political debate in the UK. And that's where I'm going to hand over to Dan.
Thanks very much. I will try to be 15 minutes, but I've always had problems with timings. You know, I have to remember what my mother said about the big hand and the little hand. So forgive me if I either wildly undershoot or go on forever. Picking up from where Larry left off, David Cameron's January 2013 offer of an in-out referendum on EU membership did not come out of the blue. We believe it was the result of two intertwined developments that added up to British disillusionment with European Union membership. The first, which Larry touched on, was the tarnishing of the European economic miracle in the wake of the launch of the single currency in January 1999. No more were the Eurozone countries self-evidently superior in their economic management to Britain. The second was what we believe was the growing realisation that the constitutional arrangements of the EU, as they had developed from the mid-80s onwards, did not suit either the mood or the political mechanisms of British politics and the British people. To start with the economic point, it's hard from the perspective of 2016 to recall that very recently membership of the single currency was being sold to the British on the same basis as had been membership of the European Community, later European Union, and the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, that it was an opportunity to import wholesale the winning ways of continental economies, specifically Germany. Rather, as it's possible to buy ready-made Irish pubs that can be assembled from kit form delivered anywhere in the world, German-style industrial and economic success could be effortlessly transmitted to the UK through the medium of the single currency. This argument had served the pro-European lobby well in this country. It had worked in 1973 when we joined. It worked again 2 years later when we voted to remain. And it worked in 1990, as Larry mentioned, with regard to joining the ERM. It didn't work at the turn of the millennium in relation to joining the euro. Why not? A couple of reasons, I would argue. First, Britain's decision to sit out the first wave of membership created the space in which the public could observe that the miracle economies were looking distinctly less miraculous. Slow growth in the core eurozone was matched by wild booms in the periphery, notably Spain, Ireland, and Greece. The inevitable product of a single interest rate appropriate for no country in particular. This space, this wait-and-see period, turned out eventually to be critical in keeping Britain out of the single currency bloc, because it proved the truth of the assertion that one-size-fits-all interest rates don't suit anybody. By the time of Tony Blair's third election victory in 2005, it had become clear that the predictions of disaster that were Britain to fail to sign up for EMU had been very wide of the mark. What had in fact taken place was entirely conventional. An exchange rate opened up between sterling and the euro. Trade and investment then moved back and forth across that exchange rate in the normal way. The city had not decamped to Frankfurt. The big motor companies that had moved to Britain in the 80s, such as Nissan and Toyota, had not upped sticks for the single currency bloc. Britain's place on the world stage had not been hopelessly compromised by its miserable failure to apply to join this chic new international club, or, to mix metaphors, to take its place at the top table. Indeed, the UK's highly controversial involvement in the March 2003 invasion of Iraq and subsequent occupation suggested no connection at all between a high-profile international role and membership of the single currency bloc. We argue in the book, in fact, that Mr. Blair, aware that even he enjoyed only a limited amount of political capital, chose to spend it on Iraq rather than what would probably have been an unsuccessful attempt to persuade the British people to vote in a referendum to join the euro. Apart from anything else, the Iraq war needed just a simple vote in Parliament. The public's consent was not required. During the run-up to the financial crisis and Great Recession, the set-piece example of the eurozone's difficulties was its number two economy, France. Presidents Chirac and Sarkozy, accounting between them for 17 years of centre-right rule, had seemed permanently unable to decide whether they were tough, single-minded reformers or whether they were preservers of republican values and the French social model. Strikes and riots at the merest suggestion of trimming long-established social entitlements probably gave the British a picture of France that was as misleading as the view abroad of 70s Britain as a strike-bound basket case had been. But it was certainly hard to square go-list dithering on the economy with the much-admired country whose superb express trains, hyper-productive industries, ungrudging arts subsidies and peerless education system had been held up in the 80s as an example for Britain to follow, not least by emulating France's full-blooded commitment to European integration. Germany, the other engine of European integration, pressed ahead with the sort of labour market reforms that France, rightly or wrongly, ducked. But freeing up employment regulations and making out-of-work benefits less attractive was unlikely to prove particularly inspiring in the UK, which had very much been there and done that already. Germany's training and apprenticeship system remained admired, but this was not enough upon which to build a case for full-scale emulation of continental economics. Britain, of course, had its very own serious economic weaknesses at this time, about which we wrote many times. A huge build-up of private debt, an over-reliance on financial services and property speculation, and a chronic current account deficit. This last still very much with us as we speak. The point isn't that Britain was a shining example of economic probity, but rather that when it came to ways and means by which the weaknesses could be addressed, there was little inspiration from the other side of the channel. In fact, there was a blink-and-you-miss-it revival of the old-time European religion in the immediate wake of the August 2007 credit crunch and subsequent financial crisis, when it was suggested that the issue of UK Euro membership could be back on the agenda. The credit crunch, we were told, had exposed the flaws of Anglo-Saxon capitalism. This was very much a British and American incubated crisis. Such a line of argument, of course, rather overlooked the fact that the credit crunch was triggered on August 9, 2007, by the distinctly non-Anglo-Saxon BNP Paribas suspending three of its investment funds. And talk of the superiority of continental financial institutions rang a little hollow after huge problems were discovered in French, German and Italian banks. Once the ructions in the single currency bloc started to gain traction at the start of the current decade, it became painfully clear that those of us who had argued all along that the euro was not and could never be a progressive project were being proved right. Furthermore, as the crisis in the eurozone ground on year after year, with bailout and austerity regimes for Ireland, Portugal, Cyprus and, infamously, Greece, the now dormant issue of British membership of the single currency gave way to the, from the establishment point of view, far more ominous question of whether the UK would remain an EU member at all. Before moving into the current decade and the road to the June 23 referendum result, I'd like to pause a moment and look beyond the proximate cause of the eurozone's lack of appeal in Britain at this time, its economic sluggishness and mishandling of the financial crisis, and go back briefly to what may have proved to be a decisive factor in both keeping Britain out of the single currency and eventually propelling it out of the EU altogether, the ERM experience. Larry just covered this in much more depth. All I would like to say is that precisely the same people who had enthused about ERM membership were now either openly extolling the benefits of abolishing the pound and joining the single currency, or by calling for the option to remain on the table and for the country to prepare and decide. This time round, however, in the phrase later to be made famous by Mr. Michael Gove, people had had enough of experts. I ought to say at this point, in all fairness, that my co-author and fellow speaker tonight spotted the long-run impact of the ERM experience long before I did. Unlike him, I assumed the pro-Euro lobby would be able to rely on fading memories to have at least a fighting chance of bamboozling Britain into joining the single currency. After all, joining the ERM had actually been quite popular in October 1990, when we signed up. Less than a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall, it seemed that history was moving in one direction only. Nor was there any guarantee that the unpopularity of the European project in the wake of the ERM recession would not be replaced by renewed public affection, especially if articulated by a charismatic leader such as Tony Blair. As it happened, I was wrong, and I'm very pleased that I was. This, then, is the economic background to David Cameron's January 2013 referendum pledge and what happened afterwards. But there is also, I believe, a constitutional background as well. Prior to the 1986 Single European Act, which brought about the single market regime, the mechanisms of the European community were of little interest to most people in Britain. Deliberations in Brussels about the green pound and pigmeat subsidies were a guaranteed turn-off. More to the point, the machinery of community decision-making seemed to impinge little on either the government or the people of Britain. Elections to the European Parliament attracted low voter turnout, and most people neither knew nor cared about the identity of their MEP. Such controversy as was generated by community membership sprang from two sources: the alleged unfairness of Britain's club membership fees, and figures purporting to show that the housewife was being rooked on her shopping bills thanks to the common market. All that changed from the late 80s onwards, and for all the talk of subsidiarity, it changed in one direction only. Those coalition ministers who had served in government in the John Major years were reportedly astonished as to the extent to which the EU had inserted itself into Westminster and Whitehall decision-making in the intervening 13 years. This may have mattered less had the machinery of EU government resembled more closely the UK's own constitutional arrangements. Instead, British students of power politics were confronted with quite alien structures. A parliament that is not really a parliament, five presidents, none of whom is actually a president, a council of ministers that is rather more like a parliament than is the parliament itself, although it meets behind closed doors, and trialogues among rival power centres. And all this is without mentioning either the Court of Justice, that is charged with always finding in favour of more Europe rather than less, and the Commission, a sort of civil service with a monopoly on proposing legislation. Just as by 2016, the economics of the EU's flagship project, the euro, was shown to have had quite dire consequences, quite at odds with the talk of shiny progressive internationalism that had accompanied its launch, so by the time of the referendum had the endlessly repeated promises that the EU was going to do less and do it better been shown to be utterly false. For example, the programme of the current Slovakian presidency of the EU runs to 34 pages. Its priorities include the following, quote, developing the talent and potential of young people by introducing attractive approaches to youth work, quote. Then the mutual recognition of qualifications of workers on inland waterways. And, quote, measures to support young researchers with a focus on increasing the attractiveness of scientific careers, end quote. As with the euro, the EU's governance can't be reformed. Sufficient numbers of people recognise this on June the 23rd. Years of lies about how the argument in Brussels is going Britain's way failed to wash. Now the EU is going to lose one of its four members of the group of seven rich nations and one of its two nuclear powers. What happens now? Shorn of naysaying Britain, the EU could seek to put the single market under a single government, to create a new state with its own armed forces, cabinet, welfare system, a parliament that is really a parliament, and a president who really is a president. Such a course would hit the immediate obstacle of the redundancy of 27 heads of government and heads of state, many of whom are likely to object to the indignity of being bundled out of the exit. More profoundly, the negotiations needed to create such an entity would be torturous in the extreme. An alternative would be to devolve into a looser grouping, to ditch the EU's federalist pretensions and instead focus on three or four core areas in which Brussels would have deep but limited powers, perhaps trade, the environment and competition policy. The euro would probably have to be one of those areas, but then the euro is at the heart of the crisis. It may, of course, be possible to do both, with a core group of countries pressing ahead with political integration and the periphery remaining on the outside. Already there are six East European countries that are obliged to join the euro at some point, but which show no sign of doing so, and two countries, Denmark and Sweden, that have chosen not to join. The trouble with that is that the eight strong periphery would leave Greece, Italy and other countries that have shown themselves unsuited to membership inside the core area. To sum up, I fear there are no easy solutions. Worse, there may ultimately prove to be no difficult ones either. The single currency was the most obvious manifestation of a wrong turning after the events of 1989. Now the people of the Eurozone are crawling from the wreckage. Thanks very much.